Ashley, as you know, I love classics.
Like Greek and Roman literature and history?
Well, yes, but also classic style. And I love what's been going on at Burberry. The house's new chief creative officer, Daniel Lee, has been mining the archives and reimagining some of its best-loved pieces.
He's been doing some great things with the Burberry check. I particularly loved seeing the check on their new rocking horse handbag, which you know I've been eyeing for Mother's Day.
Of course, Mother's Day, that's coming up. Well, just want to say I spotted some beautiful wallets and card cases also from the rocking horse collection. How many days until my birthday, Ashley?
Oh, Michael, it's coming up sooner than you think. Perhaps an Ivy? I have lots of ideas. Check out all of our favorites at Burberry.com. Happy Saturday. It's May 4th, 2024, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
Although, Michael, let's be real. Within 24 hours, you're going to be in London. We're having dinner together, and it's the most exciting thing that's happened in the UK since, I don't know, the coronation? Okay, now look, I'm not sure if this is related to your visit or not, but in world news, King Charles is back in action. He has made his first public appearances this week, although it seems he doesn't have any time to see Prince Harry during his upcoming scheduled visit. Meanwhile, in other filial matters, Donald Trump has signaled that if he wins back the presidency, Eric and Don Jr. will be taking on leadership roles in his transition team. If that's not one more reason to vote for Biden, then I don't know what is. Meanwhile, a bit of good news. Here in the UK, a game-changing clinical trial is underway for a vaccine against melanoma. It's made using the mRNA technology that was pioneered in the COVID vaccine. The early results are incredibly promising, and that is a bit of good news that we love. On that bit of good news, Michael, let's get to it.
Let's get to it, because we have a wonderful show today packed with wonderful guests. For decades, the international pop contest Eurovision has been a source of harmless fun for millions. This year, unfortunately, people are bracing for violence, and Jonathan Margolis will tell us why. Then, for decades, Brooke Astor was the beloved queen of New York society. Late in her life, however, her son Anthony was convicted of swindling millions from her and taking advantage of her mental decline. The scandal rocked the Upper East Side, and Anthony was sent to prison. But, as Michael Gross reveals this week, Anthony left behind a secret. And Gross, who knows the dramas of the social set like few other writers, is here to tell us all about it. And finally, on Strange Stories of a Different Sort, our own Paulina Prosnitz is here to tell us about Sarah J. Maas. You may not know her, but she is the Taylor Swift of book publishing and has taken over the bestseller list with a new genre called romanticy that comes complete with kinky elves. That's all I can say. And Paulina will tell us more about Maas and explain how this author has sold 38 million books. So Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Michael, let's start with Eurovision. This is a contest I failed to understand until I lived here in the UK. And now I have a newfound appreciation of this bizarre world of pop stars competing for various accolades. Jonathan Margolis, who's our technology columnist here at Airmail, is here to explain it all. Welcome, Jonathan.
Nice to be here.
Okay, Jonathan, is it accurate to describe Eurovision as a global version of American Idol?
Well, it's kind of not global. That's the problem. It started out as a system test for something very dull called the European Broadcasting Union. 1956, there were like 8 countries who would sing songs at each other. But then over the years, it's kind of expanded into this insane kind of kitsch fest of just glorious garbage, really, and fantastic stage shows, which mean nothing, and songs which are mostly just appalling. But the fun of it is such that I don't think I've missed one since I've been a grown-up. It's just too wonderful for words. It's the most wonderful way of getting rid of 3 or 4 hours on a Saturday evening. The excitement of this voting, which is, again, complete rubbish, because everybody votes for their friendly neighbours. The corruption is kind of part of the fun, because if it was done fairly, the stupidity and the meaninglessness of it all would become obvious, but it becomes a spectacle just because it's so awful.
And Jonathan, it consumes the news cycle over here for weeks, it seems, but how long does the competition actually last?
The competition, it starts in the sort of fall of the year before, when the national juries shows in all the different countries where it's decided which is going to be their entry. But I have to qualify you on this question if it consumes the news cycle over here. It consumes the news cycle everywhere except the United Kingdom, where it is a huge, humongous, gigantic joke. And nobody in mainland Europe, all the other bits of which are deemed to be Europe, which can be like Azerbaijan or Australia or Iceland, the places aren't even in Europe, but deemed to be part of Europe for the sake of this crazy show. Here we have a completely different view of it. Because if you think about it, and I don't like to be too nationalistic here, but if the UK took it seriously, they'd just put in Adele or Ed Sheeran or Coldplay or even wheel out the Rolling Stones, and we completely walk it. But as a matter of a tradition and kind of decency, we always put in something that's even worse than the average. So we always put in a note opener, and sometimes there's a kind of a one of those very British kind of reverse snobbery things where there's huge prestige in getting what we call nul point, because the voting is done in French and English for some reason, whereas all the songs are in English. Most of the songs are in English. And so when Britain gets a zero, which we've done a couple of times, I think, purely to show it's a kind of noblesse oblige, I think. I don't know what it is. It's just something that's evolved meaninglessly over decades.
So, Jonathan, the most discussed entrant in this year's Eurovision competition is, in fact, a 20-year-old named Eden Golan, who is from Israel. What is she going to be facing when she shows up next week in Malmö, Sweden, for the competition's kickoff?
Well, this is very worrying, because as a journalist, you kind of want things to be exciting. But this kind of exciting, I think we can do without, because Israel has a very good history in the Eurovision Song Contest, despite not being in Europe. They've won it four times, including, I have to say, a transgender person won it in 1997. And a little bit of me wants to be going around college campuses with a megaphone saying, oh, by the way, the hated Israel won with a transgender person, because then maybe I solve everything, because nobody would know who to support after that. But put it this way, 2013, when Israel last came to Malmö in southern Sweden, which is regarded by Jews as possibly the unsafest place in Europe. It has something like a third Muslim population. It's very radical. It's very socialist. Local council is very socialist. It's not a great place to be for Jews. It's certainly not a place to be for Israelis. And in 2013, before there was any Gaza war, the ferocity of the current Gaza war, you had the Israeli delegation pretending to be from Cyprus. So they would get in a taxi and it was apparently really, really nasty. Now, it will be that squared or cubed this year. I can't understand how this poor girl, and I know nothing about her other than she's 20, so it's, whatever's happening isn't her fault, how she's going to get out of her hotel room. The real concern is that either it's just going to be embarrassing to see a 20-year-old being given like no applause. I could see it being complete silence when she comes on stage, or anything could happen. Not going to be a good outcome. And nobody's kind of talking about this yet. This is all happening this coming week. And it's just a very worrying situation, which I don't think even the Israelis have given it much consideration, because a little bit of me was hoping they would just kind of gracefully withdraw and say, this is going to cause too much trouble, we won't come. But they insisted on coming, which they have every right to do. And the European Broadcasting Union supported their participation. But what happens next week, anyone's guess. And I think there is a possibility, and I don't say this with any relish, that it could get really nasty.
And tell us, Jonathan, a little bit about the population of Malmö and why this makes for an especially fraught situation.
Malmö is a port city. It's on the south of Sweden. It is traditionally, going back well over 100 years, been a place of refuge for people coming from the Second World War. Before the Second World War, the Swedes were operating what they called white ships, bringing concentration camp survivors out of Germany after World War II. It's a cosmopolitan place. It's incredibly close to Copenhagen. It's linked by a bridge. I don't know if everybody remembers The Bridge, which was a sort of police procedural, which was based in Copenhagen, but it's either Malmö or Copenhagen, but the two are, although they're in different countries, they're inextricably linked. It's about a 20-minute drive from one to the other. But Malmö had just had this reputation as a safe harbor. And so, ironically, thousands, tens of thousands of Jews came there after the war, and they later dispersed. A huge amount went to the US, a huge amount went to Australia and so on. But there's a small rump, about 400 Jews left in Malmö. Since all the various turbulations in Europe and Africa, it's built up a population which is now, I believe, a third from something like 40 different countries. But there's an enormous, in the tens of thousands, rump of Palestinians living there. And apparently it's all been going quite well. I mean, I spoke the piece I've written this week. I spoke to somebody from the one remaining synagogue in Malmö who said, we've been doing okay. We've had school parties coming through. But as he put it, we went five steps forward over the past few years with intercommunal relations. And then three steps forward and five back, as he put it, because now he said, even for Malmö people who aren't Muslim or different Muslim, because there are Muslims from Balkans from all over the world, even the white kids, it's become cool, as he put it, to be anti-Semitic. So they've given up on kind of talks in schools in Malmö on the Holocaust or anything like that. The Jews are living very much undercover. Even the Israeli authorities have recommended that that if there are any fans of travel to Malmö, that they don't carry any kind of affiliation, any flags or paraphernalia that shows they're supporting the Israeli entry. It's an unfortunate alignment of stars almost, because the only reason he's in Malmö is that Sweden keeps winning the damn thing. And this is the fifth time. And if you win, you have to host the next year's show. Now, this led rather hilariously to Ireland deliberately losing at one point because they kept having to host the Eurovision and they were running out of money. So they deliberately put in an even more terrible song and they got rid of the Eurovision. Sweden keeps getting it. They've had it in Stockholm. They've had it in Gothenburg. So it came to be in Malmö again. And now we have this rather unpleasant coincidence of things happening. And I'll be, along with possibly millions of other people, I'll be very glad when we get to the end of this without anything nasty happening.
It's interesting though, Jonathan, how this particular competition has become sort of an avenue for national pride, right? And for the expression of sovereignty and legitimacy among nations. I mean, is this just another example of how the conflict in Gaza is sort of touching every facet of the global experience?
I would say that nationalism and the Eurovision Song Contest have gone hand in hand since ever. I mean, the voting is the most absurd thing because everybody knows, for example, that Cyprus will vote for Greece and Greece will vote for Cyprus, and the Scandinavians, bizarrely, kind of quite corrupt about it. Sweden votes for Norway, Norway votes for Finland. So none of that means anything. But nationalism is bored through the entire thing. The whole DNA of the thing is nationalistic. Nobody's really saying that this is the best song. It's just maybe it's the catchiest on the night. The fact that the songs are almost all in English is a bit weird, really. And if any nation puts in something kind of vaguely folkloric. I've watched all 37 entries before the competition. And one of them, I think it's Armenia or one of the old Soviet republics, has put in a kind of a folkloric dancing thing. And you immediately know that they'll get votes from their neighbors, but they'll be way, way down the pecking order. Where Gaza comes into it, it's similar in a way to the way the Ukrainians started winning it as soon as the Russians invaded them. Because in the case of Russia, Russia was thrown out. Now, it's never been quite clear why Israel wasn't thrown out. I think it's because they didn't invade somebody else's sovereign territory. There's a technical reason why Israel has been allowed to take part. So I think it's left them with a headache that they're not, the organizers aren't really prepared to acknowledge. So I've been listening to all the kind of pre-publicity today, just bits on the radio, and it's all very chirpy, cheerful. Everything's going to be fantastic. It's going to be the best Eurovision ever. And there is this kind of elephant in the room situation where nobody's mentioning that it could end up being a riot. I mean, the guy at the synagogue, the spokesman in Malmö, told me, and I quoted him in my piece, that it could end in riots. And as he put it, riots would be a relatively good outcome. What can you say? I wouldn't even want to say what the bad outcome could be. I don't know. This is not how a song competition should happen.
I think it's safe to say that this is one Eurovision competition that the UK press is going to be covering, as well as the rest of the news agencies all over the world.
Indeed.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. Great story.
Okay.
Take care, Jonathan.
You guys, nice to see you.
Well, actually, Michael Gross has a story about a conflict of a different sort, one that took place in the blue blood world of New York society. Years ago, the son of Brooke Astor, who was the grand dame of the social set, was convicted of stealing millions from her. He was sent to prison and has since died, but a new posthumous memoir by him has what might be the last word in that scandal. Michael Gross, who is the author of several books, including Flight of the Wasp, The Rise, Fall, and Future of America's Ruling Class, is here to take us inside the story. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, great to be with you, Michael.
So, Michael, for those people who might not live in New York City, tell us a little bit about who Brooke Astor was and who her son Anthony Marshall was.
Well, Brooke Astor was for a long, long time, for decades, the queen of New York society. She was standing on a mountain of cash that she inherited from her third husband, whose name was Vincent Astor, who was the great heir to the Astor real estate fortune, and prior to that, to the Astor fur business fortune. And he was one of the richest men in New York. And when Brooke Astor inherited everything in the 60s, she decided that she was going to give it all away. And now, whether or not she decided this or not, I think she probably did make herself famous and beloved in the process. And she did that. All that time, she had a son from husband number one, who was an alcoholic, who married Brooke when she was 16. The son, Tony Marshall, took husband number two's last name because he hated his alcoholic father and he liked husband number two, even though husband number two also ignored him, sent him off to boarding boarding school. Basically, Tony was an ignored and abused child who tried to create his own life, but at every turn found himself tied to his mother. He was successful in various things. He was a war hero. He got a Purple Heart. He was Iwo Jima. He was a lieutenant in the Marines. He was a U.S. ambassador, admittedly a post bought probably with his mother's money. He was a Broadway producer. But we, the observers of New York society, got to know Tony as his mother's pull toy. He ran her office. He invested her personal funds while she ran the Vincent Astor Foundation. And he was absolutely subordinate to his mother, who was considered a living monument in New York.
Right. She's revered. Then, late in her life, Anthony is accused and convicted of swindling millions from her and taking advantage of her mental decline. It becomes tabloid fodder, as you note in your story this week. How does that happen? And who's behind that?
Well, Mrs. Astor had a very long decline. And during the decline, Tony was, for a long time, his mother's guardian. She had dementia. She had many illnesses. Basically, as with many, many old people, and we're talking about a very old person, her life shrank. And surrounding her were a group of people who were her society friend. And suddenly, like a bolt from the blue, a complaint was filed by Tony's twin son. Tony also had three marriages. The twin sons were from the first wife. Again, not a great familial relationship, father and his twin sons. One of the two sons, Philip Marshall, went to court and asked that his father be removed as his mother's guardian. It was done in secret, and he was backed by a very formidable trio of figures in New York: David Rockefeller, the head of Chase Manhattan Bank, Henry Kissinger, the diplomat and former Secretary of State, and Annette De Laurentiis, who was at that point the vice chairman of the board of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I think she was still the wife of Oscar De Laurentiis. I don't think she was his widow yet. She was also a member of the board of the New York Public Library and was considered a leader of New York society.
So you have this trio of Annette De Laurentiis, David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, and as you report in your story this week, they all have come back into this eye again because, as you reveal, Tony left. He was imprisoned. And after he got out of prison, he wrote his side of the story. And he comes after these people now, right? His book came out after he died and no one paid attention to it last year. And so what is he arguing? What is his side of the story in this book this week?
Well, the book is a memoir and it goes all through his childhood. And the first 350 pages have nothing to do with his trials and tribulations over his mother. But in the last pages of the book, about 100, 120 pages, he takes off after Annette De Laurentiis, Henry Kissinger, Mrs. Astor's butler, a guy named Chris Ely, and their friends in a major way. And what he basically says is that Annette De Laurentiis wanted to step into Mrs. Astor's shoes and become the next queen of New York. She had a plot to do that. She was backed up by Henry Kissinger, who was just trying to be a good friend to Brooke Astor, and David Rockefeller, who was a good friend to them all. But Tony alleges any number of things, that Mrs. Astor was basically swept out of her apartment one night and checked into a hotel while both Tony and Mrs. Astor's doctor was both out of town. She was taken to a hospital where her doctor did not have privileges. She was socked away in a room behind an armed guard. He alleges that the cause of the hospitalization, which was dehydration, was something that was forced on her, that she was then force-fed against her will. This goes on and on. It's gothic to the extreme. And the basic gist of it is that Tony was standing in the way of Mrs. Astor's fortune going to charities that Mrs. De Laurentiis wanted to get the money. And Tony was in the way. And so there was a cabal to get rid of him. And the cabal was aided and abetted by a butler whom Tony Marshall had fired when his mom stopped entertaining, when her decline was such that she was basically living, waiting to die. And she wasn't entertaining and she didn't need staff. And in order to save money, Tony fired this butler, closed down her country house that she didn't go to anymore because she needed to be near her doctors. But what the book does is it sheds a light on things that were being said Interestingly, the Toni Marshall trial started 15 years ago last week. Opening statements were last Saturday, 15 years ago. And so all of this is stuff that was being said around New York 15 years ago, but was never said out loud, was never printed, because the world ganged up on Toni Marshall. The world decided that he was guilty. The world decided that he was an abusive child. And there was no arguing with that. And Toni kept his mouth shut all through the trial. But secretly, I mean, this was only revealed, in fact, by Airmail's editor, Grayton Carter, in Vanity Fair in 2008 or 9, that Marshall was writing a memoir. And then it was never heard about again until this summer, when a Christian vanity press somewhere in the South published this book, In the Shadow of a Monument, it's called. And it is Toni's side of the story. And it's a cri de coeur. I describe it in my story as catnip for anyone with a taste for blackened sacred cow.
Yeah, or as you noted a minute ago, gothic in the extreme. I mean, it is extraordinary what you reveal this week and what Toni, just to be clear, alleges about De La Renta, Rockefeller, and Kissinger. And as you also note in your story, I mean, the whispers were not just about Toni and Mrs. Astor, but also she was not the prim, proper queen, perhaps, that people think she was. She had her whispers about her. Where do you stand on all this, Michael? I mean, Toni's dead. Mrs. Astor's dead.
Well, I honestly believe that the truth is somewhere in the middle. Toni obviously made some huge mistakes. But at the time, I was writing a book about the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And so I was writing about all of these characters, Henry Kissinger, the Rockefellers, Mrs. De La Renta, and Toni Marshall and Brooke Astor. And I back then recall having a conversation with another social journalist who described Toni as a dog that had been beaten for years. And this person said to me, you hit a dog often enough, it's going to turn around and bite you. And so I always felt that there was a story that had never been told because it was socially incorrect to tell it. Brooke Astor was on a pedestal and no one could tear her off that pedestal, even if she did have feet of clay. The remarkable thing about this memoir is that it reveals that forever after, inscribed on her pedestal, there's going to be an asterisk. And the asterisk says, well, you might want to listen to her only son's side of this story, too. And that's what I feel, is that Brooke Astor was not 100% pure in this story. There was another side of it. And I think it's valuable that he wrote this book. I don't expect that very many people are going to want to read it because he's dead, of course, but he's a public enemy and he's reviled for good reason. But Brooke Astor's hands were not clean. The hands of those who got involved in this and tried to destroy Toni and Charlene Marshall, their hands are not clean. It was not the simple black and white story that was told at the time.
Well, it is, thanks to you in this week's issue of Airmail, a riveting story that you've pulled together. As always, I mean, no one knows society squabbles and foibles and better than you do, Michael. It's a fantastic story. I see the understanding and intimate knowledge you bring to it is fascinating. And you're right, she's stuck with an asterisk now, and he's got, if not the last word, one of the last words on her. So thank you for joining us from Venice, and we look forward to your next story, Michael.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ashley, as you know, I love classics.
Like Greek and Roman literature and history?
Well, yes, but also classic style. And I love what's been going on at Burberry. The house's new chief creative officer, Daniel Lee, has been mining the archives and reimagining some of its best-loved pieces.
He's been doing some great things with the Burberry check. I particularly loved seeing the check on their new rocking horse handbag, which you know I've been eyeing for Mother's Day.
Of course, Mother's Day, that's coming up. Well, just want to say I spotted some beautiful wallets and card cases also from the rocking horse collection. How many days until my birthday, Ashley?
Oh, Michael, it's coming up sooner than you think. Perhaps an Ivy? I have lots of ideas. Check out all of our favorites at Burberry.com. Okay, so for those of you who are thinking that Gen Z doesn't read, then you haven't heard of romantasy. This is a newish genre that's a blend of fantasy and romance, and it is all the talk of book talk. That's the bookish corner of TikTok. Paulina Prosnitz, an associate editor at Airmail, joins us to interpret. Welcome, Paulina.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Paulina, you report in your piece that most young women under age 24 have a book by a woman named Sarah Moss. You've called her the Taylor Swift of publishing. That's high praise. So who is she?
So Sarah J. Moss is one of the biggest authors in romanticism right now, and not just in romanticism. She is the best-selling author of 2024 thus far across all genres, across all mediums.
Wait. So she's like beating J.K. Rowling and like Stephen King and like Danielle Steele.
Yes.
And yet we've never heard of her, Michael. What does this make us?
She's just crushing everyone.
Yes, pretty much. I mean, it's just the first quarter, but given how the trend is going so far, I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of this year, yes, she is probably going to be the best-selling author.
What are her books and why are so many people reading them?
Well, romanticism as a genre, which is a combination of fantasy and romance, is just having a huge moment in publishing right now. I mean, if you walk into any bookstore, if you open TikTok, if you glance the bestsellers list, you can't help but notice like romanticism books are just everywhere right now. And it's a unique thing because when you think about fantasy in general, I think all of us imagine kind of young men in their basements learning Elvish and playing Dungeons and Dragons and whatnot. So it's interesting to think about how fantasy, it seems, has kind of swung a pendulum a bit. And now it's very popular with young women. And I think the reason for that is this introduction of romance content into the fantasy books.
Okay, but this is not just like Valentine's and moonbeams. Like, this is some pretty serious stuff. So what kind of content are we seeing?
So this genre is unique in that it follows a very cohesive set of tropes. And that's usually revolving around a young female protagonist who's usually attractive. And she at some point strikes up a romance with a also attractive male lead. And there's magic. And there's prophecy and there's the classic elements of fantasy. But at some point, this really strong brand of romance is introduced and it eventually gets like quite explicit. And I think that's something that the fans are really looking for in this genre. And it's quite transparent that that's kind of the main appeal of these books for them.
But you mentioned the tropes here. I'm just curious because you identified 9 of them in your story this week. The last one, well, number 8 is for plot reasons, there must also be an all-powerful supernatural villain intent on destroying the world. And number 9 is sexy elves never hurt. I don't know what that means. So tell us why sexy elves.
So I think the success of these books is that they operate within the confines of the fantasy kind of shell. So there's the elements that you grow to expect, which is like elves. When you think of like Lord of the Rings type of fantasy creatures, there's elves, there's dwarves, there's magic, there's all of that. But where things kind of take a turn is like the elves are kind of sexually heightened, if that makes sense. And the main kind of premise of it is not just, you know, defeating the supernatural villain, but it's the two main leads building a romance and like going through their romantic journey. And that's kind of what takes precedent in these books.
Pauline, as I read your story, I couldn't help but wonder, I mean, does this have something to do with sort of the depersonalization of love lives these days among youth? I mean, we're reading all these statistics about how young people don't have sex anymore. They just engage with others online. How does this romanticy genre fit into all of that?
That's a really interesting point. I think it is kind of important to note that these books are more popular with overwhelmingly with young women. And that might play into this whole thing of maybe women are going to books and online communities rather than going out to the bars and meeting men or meeting whatever their romantic prince is. And yeah, it is an interesting trend with my female friends. They're all reading these books and what that means for their real life romance, whether they're going to start comparing it with the stuff they're reading in these books, that's yet to be seen. Hopefully not, because I don't think they're going to encounter any sexy elves in the streets of New York, but it is an interesting phenomenon for sure.
I think it's an astute point because, as you know in your reporting, men are sort of gravitating towards video games, which they isolate themselves, and women are sort of like over here on the other side. She has sold 38 million copies globally. This year alone, as you say also, she sold 360,000 copies. She's outpacing J.K. Rowling. So, and I just want to understand romanticism also. These stories, are they taking place in a fantasy world like George R.R. Martin kind of thing? Or are they in 2024 on the streets of New York?
They're very much so in a sort of Middle Earth type world. So it's completely separate from our world. Yeah, operating in its own sense of like rules and settings. And something people really like about Sarah J. Moss's books, for as much parts of it are ridiculous, she is really a world builder. And that's comes from, I think, back in her childhood, she actually was the president of the Lord of the Rings club in high school where she went to Dalton. So she's really pulling inspiration from these like classic fantasy worlds, which is something her fans, I think, really appreciate.
And Paulina, when I think of fantasy books that we think of those kind of 1970s, 60s paperback bodice rippers with guys like Fabio on the cover, and seem sort of down to mid-market, but these are books that are selling, as you said, all your friends are reading them. This woman went to Dalton. Are these aimed at Gen Z professional women of a different sort?
It's kind of funny because when Sarah J. Maas's first book came out, I think back in 2012, they were originally classed as YA, so young adult. And then as they became more and more popular, it became very clear that they were far too explicit to be young adults. They were moved into new adult fiction or whatnot. But originally it was meant as a young adult kind of genre. And now it's kind of moved more towards young women in their early 20s. And I don't know what the intended demographic was, but that's definitely who are reading the books now.
So like when I was that age, Paulina, just 6 months ago or whatever, like I was reading Bridget Jones. Has this kind of replaced chick lit?
I think this has definitely replaced chick lit. I mean, it's kind of interesting. It almost feels like every young woman in the country, if not the world right now, is in one giant book club reading these books. Like if you ask any woman you know, like maybe under the age of 24, they will have read one of Sarah J. Maas's books, or maybe they're currently reading it and it's what's on their nightstand right now. It's just kind of this all-consuming phenomenon right now that it's really the only thing that I can think that compares to it is when we were all reading Harry Potter when we were children. That's kind of how common these books have become for my generation.
So speaking of as the guy in the room here, if I were a guy in my 20s, I'd be reading one of these books so I knew how to talk to a woman when I met her.
I think that's great.
You don't have to respond to that, Paulina. Okay, so in my house, Paulina, as you know, I have two little kids, and we always say reading is reading, even though they're reading junky comic books instead of classics of literature, and it drives me insane. Is that true here? I mean, or is this romantasy genre siphoning off market share from literary fiction, and is that a problem?
I think some of the biggest defenders of the genre say this, like it's getting people reading, it's giving a huge boost to the publishing industry. Bloomsbury, Sarah J. Maas's publisher, is just releasing record numbers. It's doing great things for the publishing industry, and you can't deny that. And I don't really think it's taking any kind of market shares from other books. The people I know who are reading these books, they're not people who read on a regular basis. I think some of my friends who are reading these books, this is the first book they've read since they graduated college and they had to for a class. So, I mean, I think when you look at it in that way, it's really doing great things with just getting people reading again.
And are these books, has Hollywood come calling yet? I mean, obviously it seems in that, as we say, the Lord of the Rings and even maybe 50 Shades of Grey territory, it seems like an adaptation of at least one of these has to be on its way.
Yes. I think Hollywood is going to come for this genre in a really big way. I mean, one of Sarah J. Maas's more popular series is A Court of Thorns and Roses. It's already been picked up by Hulu. Doesn't have an expected release date yet, but that's on the horizon. And there's another series by an author named Rebecca Yarros called Fourth Wing that's been picked up by Amazon, and that's currently in development for a series. So I think in a few years, at least, you could expect a lot of romantasy television to come.
Okay, Paulina. Michael and I learn something new every day. Thank you for this. I'm going to go get a Sarah J. Maas novel on my Kindle and read it with pride.
Great. I think you'll like it. Thank you so much.
Michael, have you ever delved into this category? This is a safe space.
No, this is the first I've ever heard of it in this week's issue. And you?
Yeah, it really goes to show the generational divides are big and growing. No, I haven't actually. I mean, I read 50 Shades of Grey back in the day, but only on Kindle. Couldn't bring myself to buy the paperback.
And only for research purposes, I'm sure, as a journalist.
Yeah, I'm saying that in air quotes, of course.
Yes.
All right, Michael, well, it is the weekend. If you can't recommend a good romance novel, surely you've got something else you can suggest to us.
Something I want to suggest or at least talk about, because I recommended it a couple weeks ago, and then it came up in a meeting again. You mentioned it, because I feel like this is something that came out that not enough people are sort of watching, and I really want to re-recommend it and reconnect with you about it. Can we talk about Ripley on Netflix?
We should talk about Ripley on Netflix. What do you think?
I recommend it the week it came out. I feel like it's been out for a few weeks now, and I just want to sort of put it back on your radar if you haven't seen it. It is, I think, terrific. It stars Andrew Scott as Tom Ripley, Dakota Fanning. It is written and directed by Steve Zaillian, who is a fantastic director. If you ever saw The Night Of, which was on HBO, he did that. He wrote She Knows This. He wrote American Gangster, wrote The Irishman, wrote Moneyball. And I think it's, some people don't love it. I think it's great. It's shot in black and white. It's brilliant. I think it's much more of a thriller than the previous two versions of it. How about you?
Well, it's so interesting because everyone in the UK is talking about this show. I mean, I was just talking to Rachel Johnson, one of our writers at large, about it, and all of her friends are so obsessed with it that they're even having screenings. I am a Jude Law loyalist, Michael. Nothing can touch my heart quite like his version of Dickie Greenleaf's. I like those gorgeous shots of the sea and all the music and dancing and Gwyneth Paltrow in a swimsuit getting tan. Like, there's, what do you not love about that, Ripley? So the bar was set very high, but I think Andrew Scott is really incredible in this role. I mean, his acting chops just grow with every part he plays, and he's very fun to watch. So we can agree to disagree on this one.
Do what you say that's been happening in the UK. Have a viewing party. Watch all three, Purple Noon, Talented Mr. Ripley, and now Ripley. And pick your best, because look, actually, the real story here is it's about grifters and our favorite subject. So why not get a trifecta going?
I know it's true, Michael. It's just that the bar for grifter television has been set very high. We've had so many good shows recently.
This is true. And what do you have to recommend this week?
Well, I'm obsessed with Baby Reindeer, which is Richard Gadd's incredible drama that came out on Netflix last week. Have you seen it?
I've watched the first one. It's cringe-inducing for sure.
Yeah, it's totally cringe. I mean, this is based on a one-man play that premiered at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival a few years ago. It's about a stalker. It's about how he has to discover a trauma as a result of the stalker. I won't say anything more than that, but it's a really wonderful show. It's on Netflix called Baby Reindeer. It is a true story. And there have been a lot of legal issues about exposing the identities of stalkers and tons of media around this. So I think it's really big right now in the UK because it came from the UK, but expect to read a lot more about it in the US papers and press in the next few weeks. And Michael, one more thing.
Yes, dear.
We have a new issue of Airmail Look that just hit your inboxes yesterday. Airmail.news/look, edited by the one and only Linda Wells, has some really funny stories, including one about the naked dressing trend, which I shall never embrace yet. Love to read about. We also talk about social anxiety among the rich. Very fun. Jennifer Aniston shares her most loved and most loathed fitness trends. So there is tons to read at airmail.news/look. Thank you all so much for joining us. Michael and I will be in London eating at the River Cafe until further notice. Thank you all so much for joining us. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Burberry. We love you. Michael and I are going shopping there immediately after our dinner at the River Cafe. On that note, Michael, we have a reservation. Will you please read us out?
Fantastic. And just, I want to make sure that there are no sexy elves who are going to be there, but that's another story. Morning Meeting is produced by Airpipe Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. And our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Drew Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is A Cute Monster by the Buddy Colette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music, but most of all, thank you again for joining us.